Today I talk with Emmy O'Brien and Iman Abdelhadi about their dazzling and challenging book, Everything for Everyone, An Oral History of the New York Commune, 2052 to 2072. They imagine a world haunted by genocide, ecocide, disease, fascism, and viral capitalism. But rather than writing a dystopian novel, O'Brien and Abdelhadi create a complex mosaic of oral histories in which they each play the part of interviewer. The result is a story that far exceeds New York and the 20 years noted in the title. The histories cover generations across the globe and reach into the deep sources of trauma and the kinds of mutual care we will need not only to survive, but also to thrive in these frightening times. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback and suggest people to invite and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living. So thank you so much for being here. I have to say that since your book consists of you all interviewing people, and I'm going to be interviewing you, this is all going to be very meta. I might even feel myself to be a character in your book at some points, which I think is maybe part of the effect. I hope you enjoy it. Now, first, could you give us just a very rough description of the book and then tell us what led you to write it in the first place?
Sure. The book is a speculative fiction novel that imagines a transition out of capitalism and the nation state in the next few decades. But it's composed of a series of fictional oral history interviews. So we imagine ourselves in the future, and we're writing a book to celebrate the 20th anniversary of a food riot that launches the New York version of this kind of revolutionary transition. And so we're doing all of these oral histories with various actors, some who participated in the revolution, some who grew up in the new social form, which is the commune. So the book is a series of 12 interviews. We trade off as interviewers. And it was actually Michelle's idea to write the book. She had written a fictional oral history interview for an online magazine, and she invited me to do a whole novel of these interviews. And we both have a relationship with oral history as a form of research and engagement with the world. I do life history interviews for my sociological research. Michelle ran the New York Trans Oral History Project, which is a great archive that people should check out. It has 200 interviews. So we both have done this. We both are science fiction fans, and we're friends and comrades. And I had spent many years talking about politics and the future and the left. And so the book is a culmination of all of these things, is a sort of intersection of all these facets of our lives as scholars, but also of our friendship and comradeship. We pitched the book to Common Notions, and we pitched a general outline of the world and like little paragraphs about each character we thought we might write. And they encouraged us to do it, and the rest is history.
So, Emmy, do you want to talk about how you made the decision to bring on Mont? Because it starts off with the story that you write. What was the light bulb that went on in your head to say, hey, I should really bring Iman onto this?
No one's ever asked that. A man is one of the smartest, purest, funniest people I've ever met in my life. And writing is extremely stressful and very unpleasant, particularly if it goes well. And spending a lot of time, I wrote a nonfiction book roughly at the same time, Family Abolition, that I had the misfortune of writing all by myself. So when I do book tours and speak at conferences and do interviews for it, I'm just stuck by myself with an interviewer who I hardly know. And I just spent hours and hours writing it alone and running into constant frustrations and problems and nearly intractable obstacles in trying to lay out a complex book-length argument. And I did not have the great pleasure of a dear friend and comrade to be able to talk through those problems with the frequency and depth that we were able to do with Everything for Everyone. And certainly, I think it's pretty obvious to any casual reader that the book is dramatically enhanced by Iman's participation. We are each our own, the primary authors of the chapters where we present ourselves as future fictional interviewers, but also drastically rewrote each other's chapters in layering them and adding richness and depth to them with our slightly different focuses, but ultimately, like, the chapters really reflect, I think, our collaboration, both intellectually and politically and in the actual writing process as well. Yeah.
It's so interesting. I didn't know that you had actually edited or commented on each other's portions.
Extensively, yeah.
Wow, the book seems so almost seamless in a very complex way. Let me explain what I mean. It's an incredibly interesting format because you each introduce yourselves differently to your interviewees each chapter, right? Mm-hmm. So you're representing each other and creating a different, of course, in all interviews, a different dynamic takes place in that particular connection. But now in a real / fantastic way, gotten at least four participants going on at each of these intersections. This might be asking you a tricky question. What were some of the most interesting, let's say, debates about, leave it that, or no, you have to do this? What kinds of things did you find yourselves bring out in each other when you were doing the revision process?
I think there's a lot to say about our sort of respective political traditions and interests and passions that mutually reinforce and resonate in the book. And we had many years of arguments and collaborations and political development together. So I think it had a lot of overlap, a remarkable amount of overlap. Like everything that appears in the book, I think, really reflects a kind of collaborative dialogue between us. There was one argument that I remember going into the book that never ended up playing out in any of the chapters, which was, what do you do about isolated autocratic religious communities that are internally oppressive but have no interest in participating in the world of the commune on some level? And I think both of us have lots of overlap in these things, but I think our sort of deep intuitions on some level, Mann was very attuned to the horrible history of imperial violence against Muslim communities, justified on various grounds of like shallow liberal values. And I'm very attuned to the horror of what happens to trans children born into social contexts where they're quite oppressed, and the sort of desperate need to connect to an outside world as quickly as possible for their own survival. And I think this is actually a real political contradiction on some level, you know, that in the book we think about the dynamics between like indigenous sovereignty, for example, and the abolition of property and nationhood on the other, right? And like actually both of these things really matter, and how would they be dialectically interrelated to each other is a very important question. And like we made up some scenario for how the commune should deal with this, the sort of the notion of an isolated religious community, and it had some tentative agreement on it and then didn't write it into a chapter. Yeah, I think there were probably a few others, but that was the one that leaps to mind for me.
Yeah, Iman, did you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I think we each brought in, I think we brought different things to each other's work when we were editing. And I think Michelle had a lot of really interesting technical details that I think she was able to add, help me flesh out in my interviews. And I think I brought in some of the, I don't know, more colloquial aspects. But, and then I think Michelle had really interesting points about just having characters that also contradict themselves and who are inconsistent and unreliable in ways that we all are as people and as narrators of the world and of our stories. But none of that was like conflicted. It was just nice additions that we had. And yeah, I can't remember another fight besides the one that Michelle just recounted. So it was remarkably easy to collaborate.
Yeah, I can imagine that one of the reasons it's easy, A, because you're such good friends, but also you're both activists and you've been through this over and over again, rehearsed this. And I exactly had that perception about the tension and contradiction between indigenous and nation state formations. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking about a previous episode I did with a scholar named Christian A. Smith. I don't know if you know their work. Yeah, when they talk about Beatriz Nascimento and the Quilombos in Brazil, and a really interesting, realistic presentation about contradiction, even in these supposedly ideal formations, constantly renegotiating. And one thing that Beatriz Nascimento says is, what do you expect? We came out of colonialism. We can't help but have it absorb these colonial structures of violence and oppression, even as we're trying to negotiate a different world. And I got so much the same flavor in your book. Let's wind back a second, because you both talked about your extensive experience with oral histories, which I think is so important. You could have written just a standard narrative in any number of ways, collaborative or not, but to involve not just histories, but the oral histories and the kind of back and forth dynamic. What to you both is important about oral histories, particularly at this political moment?
I think oral histories, they basically allow you to think about both the kind of structure of individual lives and individual agency and the kind of broader geopolitical conditions that like structure people's lives, right? So it's the mix of the kind of like individual level and the structural and social level that we see in oral histories. And I think that's why they've been such an effective tool as a form of history. A lot of the oral history I read is from communities whose histories have not been recorded and for whom the archive is quite sparse. And I know that historians of color and Black historians in particular have really fought for oral history as a method of history. And it was something that the field was not amenable to at all. So I think there's something about honoring that legacy in a way, and then reproducing it in a more futurist dimension. I think the other thing is that it allowed us for the book to cover a much larger span of time than we would have been able to in 200 pages if we were writing a traditional novel, right? Because you have the entire lifetimes of people who are contemporary to us, and then people who are born in the commune, right? And you just are able to cover a lot more ground, and you're able to literally cover more ground geographically, right? Because you can bring in what's been happening across the globe through people international and travel and their sort of hybrid identities. Of course, New York is hybrid identity is not really the right word, but New York is such a global place, and it's full of migrants and has had layers and layers of migration. And it was a way to explore what happens elsewhere. And for me, my favorite chapter to write was the Palestine chapter. And so the events of that chapter primarily take place in Palestine. So oral history lets us do that. It lets us jump time and space in a way that I think would have been very difficult otherwise.
Yeah, I think a man summarized it quite well. Each one of the oral histories has this sort of concreteness of the physical environment in which the interview is taking place, and either the interruptions, the social dynamics of the immediate surroundings. It has the interpersonal dynamic between the interviewer and the subject. It has the psychological dynamic of what's happening for the narrator speaking, right? They're the ways that their slips and their patterns of speech and their modes of address reflect something of their trauma and psychic fracturing and process of healing and whatnot. And then you have the events they're recounting, which are their own personal trajectory, often of radicalization, coming into a role in movements, so a trajectory through movements, but then these world historical political events that they were a part of and witnessed and are trying in their varying ways to situate in context to explain their causation, their consequences, what made them possible. But they all have different causal accounts based on slightly different underlying social theories that they're deploying. And then these all add up to a world history of the mid-2040s into the early 2070s, a world history of a global communist revolution. And the oral history form really allows us to move between all of those effectively. I spent 3.5 years coordinating the New York City Trans Oral History Project, as a man alluded to, and spent a lot of time training interviewers and conducting interviews. And something that I would say is, you ask someone about their life in New York, you are asking them about racial capitalism, The dynamics of New York are so tied up with migration and gentrification and mass incarceration and global financialization and escalated police violence and like the dismantling and defense of the social welfare state. Like these things show up in working class people's accounts of their lives in New York all the time in a way that is almost inescapable. And there were a lot of things that I focused on as a way of approaching oral history, but one of them was just being attuned to what people actually say about their jobs, their material conditions, the means of their reproduction, their access to housing, their relationship to the state, that these things are central to our lives in a way that I think a lot of queer narrative that sort of mostly white and middle class and emphasized on leisure and performance and culture really downplays these elements.
Yeah.
But they're actually so central to make what makes life.
Yeah, no, that's such a great set of comments. I was thinking also of the number of different languages that are spoken in New York City. It's just this, it reflects the richness and the international quality of it. And you, in a sense, that was another kind of contradiction that I liked in your book, which is there's also the tension between staying on Earth and going to space, right? This idea of, do you reinvest in the planet or do you go to the stars? And so the reach is so immense, not just international, but interplanetary almost. And it seems so well geared to the current crisis that we're facing, which is not nation-bound exclusively, but is enmeshed in all of these things. How did you imagine, because the world is large, the specific parts that you want to make evident in the book in these 200 pages? Which areas of the globe that you want to loop in? Which kinds of political trends did you think were important to represent for whatever reason?
The book overall has an emphasis on the dimension of what Marxist feminists call social reproduction, or domestic element of people's lives, how people love and live together, how they raise children, how food is prepared, how people make decisions with those that they live in immediate proximity to, how people take care of each other, forms of care labor, right? Nursing and sex work and teaching, psychotherapy, that these sort of forms of care labor show up a lot. And I don't think these are at all exclusive. The only domain revolution, we could have had chapters that were much more centered around transformations in the production process or the sort of physical dismantling of the state or the military element of what it takes to defeat fascists. And these things are alluded to. They could have been much more elaborately developed. But I think based on our thinking, based on our research, based on our own, to some extent, elements of our engagement with social movements, we ended up putting a lot of emphasis on these social reproduction elements. And then other things, like I come out of organizing in the 1990s around ancient forest defense and certainly recognize ecological defense as being really central to human collective survival. But it's not a focus of my organizing. It hasn't been for a while. So there was definitely a moment being like, oh, we need more about ecology. We need more about ecological restoration. Yeah. And wrote a chapter that was reflective a little bit of my experience in ancient forest defense movements and some of the kinds of people I met. But this was 30 years ago in my life. And it has a little bit more distance from the kind of fabric of my life right now. And there were other topics that we could have tried to include more of and chose not to. But the book very much is conceived of partially as an invitation for people to be able to write their own chapters, that the kind of architecture and conceit and premise of the book are all designed to really lend themselves to a reader being able to look at it and being like, oh, who would I want to interview after the revolution? I should write that up. What kind of topics would be of interest to me? And we've seen many people incorporating assignments along those lines in their teaching and as a writing prompt for themselves, and are excited to be moving soon to launching a website that is an invitation for people to submit stories set in the world of everything for everyone.
Oh, fantastic. You know, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, that's a little bit of initial answer to your question.
I'll add that I think it was really important for me to think about how the state falls and the relationship between the market and the state. And this is in the background, in some cases in the foreground of the book, that effectively the increasing crises leave states unable to provide the social contracts of liberalism, right? That they're unable to provide stability in exchange for sovereignty and a monopoly on the use of violence. This is a combination of climate crisis and economic crisis. And of course, the two are interlinked. And that eventually the state is unable to sustain itself as an institution. And so you have this kind of breakdown of that. The market can't sustain itself without the state, right? And so I think that was important for me. And I think it was also important for me to think through where these breakdowns happen first. Mm. So careful reader will notice that the US and Australia is still fascist by the time of the writing of the book. But like the US is one of the last places to actually experience revolutionary transition. So the state right now, states bolster each other when they're falling apart. They're invested in the institution. But as their resources thin and as they have more and more crises to deal with, they start to turn away from bolstering each other. And you have more and more states failing. And we were seeing that now with Trump, right? This kind of turn away from the maintenance of the global social order through like US acting as this kind of police force that in some cases bolsters states and in some cases breaks them down, but effectively is abdicating this role that it's played. And I think we're going to see more and more failed states, or already have been seeing that in the last few decades. And so I wanted it to be clear that the revolution doesn't start here. And it's also a way to resist a tendency even within the Western left, especially the white left, is to think of itself as like the leadership of revolutionary change, which I find, of course, like deeply absurd and just like nonsensical in terms of how it would actually unfold in reality. And of course, I wanted to think a lot about Palestine and about indigenous struggle and these transitions of basically trying to break down settler colonial systems. Mm-hmm. Whether here or in Palestine. And so all of that is in the book. And Michelle said, it's all there in part as an invitation. None of it is fully fleshed out, but there's a scaffold that people can write into and play with and think into.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that you talked about what can happen in the classroom thanks to your book. I think that's amazing and important. And you also have a really wonderful introduction. I just wanted to flag that for all the listeners. You cover so much important territory. And we were talking a moment ago about social reproduction and production, but you also talk about abolition. So can you talk about how this works together with a kind of abolitionist ethics?
So I have a lot to say about abolition. And in some ways, I think abolition is a really necessary rejoinder or component or counterpoint or dimension or aspect of any revolutionary transition in the overcoming of class society. So I often think about the basic revolutionary dialectic as being communism and abolition. And there's a lot to say about how they have unfolded historically and their meaning. And I think about two great abolitionist traditions, the U.S. Black freedom struggle or North America Black freedom struggle and the Americas broadly in the overthrow of slavery, in the fight against Jim Crow, in the fight against mass incarceration and police violence, and its global context of the fight to overthrow and destroy colonialism. And then a kind of European Marxist tradition that has definitely swept the world at various times and been taken up across the global South, but abolishing wage labor, the property form, class society, and a kind of Hegelian element of Aufheben, of abolishing being both preserving something, lifting it up, and destroying something simultaneously. And that these traditions are deeply related to each other, right? There's a long history of Black revolutionary thinkers who draw on Marxism, who studied Hegel very directly, Angela Davis and W.E.B. Du Bois, and Martin Luther King Jr. wrote a great paper on Hegel. There's a long legacy of this. This is just so essential for us trying to think about revolutionary transition. And we see this in in the last decade and the George Floyd uprising, a lot of other movements, were abolishing the police and prisons was really the revolutionary horizon that was taken up in the streets in large numbers, that really resonated with large numbers of young people, of confronting this horribly oppressive institution and recognized that its destruction is the necessary dimension of creating freer and fuller lives together and a true basis of safety. My other book is called Family Abolition, right? Where I take something that people often, not always, have quite positive charges. Many people have quite positive feelings about their family, but looking at the history of the family as a white supremacist capitalist institution, as something that people's freedom struggles are pushing against and beyond over and over again. And that in moments where we really take care of each other in transformative, very powerful, very healing ways, it requires going beyond the nuclear family as a social structure. And we see this in many kinds of mass struggles. And so this kind of abolition as a revolutionary horizon, as an ethical practice, as a way of thinking about kind of fundamental social transformation, yep, I think has been so important in the last few decades, yep, and so important over the last two centuries, and plays a very important place in the book alongside communization or a particular way of thinking about communist transition.
I wanted to get to one of the main parts and our convergences, constellations. You just mentioned it, trauma and care, right? The form of the book is so ingenious in that you have these individuals, even when they're talking with the interviewers, and the interviewers are being very discreet and saying, I don't want to go there, maybe it's too much. But then there's a catalyst that takes place in the oral history that can be both very liberating, but also very traumatizing at the same time. And you both do such a beautiful job of navigating those moments and trying to be respectful, but also trying to draw people out without being therapeutic necessarily. So can you both talk about how you envisioned, in whatever way you want, you can pick any particular element or maybe the whole thing, the trauma that's so embedded in every one of the narratives, right, emanated from any number of sources, and also the sense of care, and not only being the object of care, but being the agent of care as well.
One of the ways that the book has been described is that it's an economy of care, or like that basically care becomes the currency of the future, or becomes the central fabric of society, that instead of what we currently have, which is care at the sort of margins. And people are rightfully frustrated with like self-care narratives. And it's like, how do I fit in like some acknowledgement of my humanity and the humanity of the people around me? But with the recognition that our right to care for ourselves and our both right and imperative to care for each other is increasingly marginalized in our society and squeezed into smaller and smaller forms. Meanwhile, we are extremely traumatized, right? We're so traumatized. And we live in, to speak to the nuclear family stuff, like we live in deeply, I think, I'm skeptical of the word unnatural, but I think in ways that no humans have ever really lived like this. I don't think we were meant to live alone as often as more people are living alone than ever before in history. We're living in these very strange ways that I think are very alien to our needs. And so we imagine a world in which care is the primary goal of pretty much every social institution. It is the thing that determines what gets done, how it gets done. It is the metric by which decisions are judged and made. And that really breaks open and unleashes a very different kind of modality of being and of dealing with trauma. Some of the outward trauma in the book is people dealing with the revolutionary trend, like having undergone the intense violence of transitioning out of capitalism and the state. But I think what's interesting is whenever folks read that, and some people feel a lot of dismay at this transition that we describe and how violent it is and how painful it is. And I find myself reminding people of the intense violence that we live in now. I actually literally just a few minutes ago walked out of my office. There's no one here because it's Sunday and I'm in yoga pants and like walking around. And I walked out of my office and there was a police officer who was like patrolling, and he has guns and he is decked out in weaponry. Yeah. And how fucking strange and violent is that? I had this moment where I was like, oh shit, my ID is not in my hand. Yeah. Does this man believe that I work here? I'm in yoga pants. We are always on the edge of violence. And that's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is the one that's being experienced by tens of millions of people.
Exactly.
Of being subject to intense state violence. And we are not dealing with that trauma now. And so this is me on a soapbox tangent from your question. But I think it's really important to read the book. And in fact, any envisioning of the future and any violence that might come with a transition out of this system, as a continuity of the violence that we live in now, we must never, I think, buy into the idea that we are living in peace. We are living under immense violence. And whether that reaches our personal doorsteps or not does not change the reality of that intensity. Yeah, that's just a reflection based on your question, but I'll also pass it to Michelle. He has more direct responses.
Yeah, people grappling with the immense trauma of the crisis of racial capitalism and the violence of its persistence and what it took to undo it, that plays a huge role in the book. People grappling with other kinds of mental illness, right? We have multiple characters talking about their experience of schizophrenia or other kinds of psychiatric conditions. And so much of the book is people reflecting and engaging on the kinds of social practices that are a part of their healing. They're finding a place in the world, they're finding social relations with others that help them survive, that help them flourish, that help them in some cases heal. We were finishing the book during COVID-19, and walking distance from my house was a hospital in Brooklyn where there were refrigerator trucks lined up out front filled with corpses. Yeah. In one news article, I read about the workers of those trucks. They get paid every day because so few of them come back the next day. It was so brutal. I have never been invited to a single event that was about grieving all the immense loss around COVID, right? Like, I know multiple people who died, and I think about this immense trauma that we don't even acknowledge, that we don't hold on any level. And what would it mean to have a society that could actually hold our trauma, that could actually give us the space to heal, to grieve, to suffer together? In the chapters, S. Adams and Connor Stevens are extremely traumatized people who have not fully recovered by any means, and their trauma shows up in the interview in a very active way. Like, Quinlan reflects extensively on the sort of process of the multiple forms of trauma in her life and what different kinds of therapeutic modalities of recovery become really important to them. An Zhao reflects about the relationship between trying to grapple with schizophrenia and his place in the social world, alongside thinking about as a kind of metaphorical relationship to his approach to ecological restoration, that sort of questions of trauma and healing play a very powerful through line to the book. And then a man was the lead author on a short story that we wrote after the book was published that was in Eflux, that was about a grieving ritual, a ritual of people interacting with holographic ghosts, characters from the book a few years later out at Fire Island, thinking about this massacre that's documented in the chapter about Belkis Chodorai, and thinking about the unmet grieving that hasn't happened yet, that it's a wonderful story about trying to make space for that and thinking about what grieving could mean in our lives very directly and very explicitly. So it's just a central through line for the book.
Yeah.
I'm a psychoanalyst. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I work as a private practice psychotherapist, and I'm in formation as a psychoanalyst and work psychoanalytically and have for a while now, and was just entering into that world as this book was finishing up. I had a previous background in social work and HIV and AIDS organizing and working in AIDS services, but the particular world of psychoanalysis, I was just beginning. And part of how I got into psychoanalysis was thinking about oral history and how transformative and powerful it can be for somebody to speak freely about their lives and to have somebody listen really substantively to that. And the very powerful and unusual things that can happen, both in giving testimonials, but also the moments and ways that people's speech exceeds the kind of testimonial form, says something much more than they intended, and can open up space in ourselves to be able to make life tolerable in the process.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned grieving, because in the fall of 2015, I was giving a course, Anti-Racism, Anti-Fascism, and then Trump got elected. And at the end of the quarter, one of the students said, "This has become a grieving community, and I don't want to let it go." And so I said, "Okay, let's." So I invented a course, just one unit, which means minimal engagement, just come and hang out, called Scholarship and Activism, just came up with a bland name. And I've taught that every quarter since the Trump election.
Oh.
And I thought during Biden, maybe not now, better keep it going. We don't know where this is going at all. And it's taking the form of anything from 40 really hardcore activists to three people sitting around a room. And when I would have the minimal class, I said, "Do you think we should keep offering this?" And they said, "It's just a space. It's just a space for us to come and do whatever we want." So it's now a tradition. But I think it's really important to respect that and to honor that, because we're talking about violence and that horrible episode with the cop. It's just, it's become so normalized, violence, that we think we haven't died yet, so it's okay. And yet that prevents us from seeing the real incursions into our lives. So this is my last question. I know it's a Sunday. I'm super grateful to you for being on. Let's talk about today a little bit. And I always leave with the hardest questions, the science of hope, even though hope is, I put that in scare brackets. But in terms of international struggle, and of course, Palestine, can you talk about things that give you a sense that there are some formations that you feel are promising and should be recognized and brought out more, or even capacities, let's say? They don't have to be movements, but just they could be more amorphous than that. But anything that you feel when you wake up in the day, you think, yeah, there's this.
I think that for so long in this movement, we thought that our task was to change public opinion and to bring the American public into awareness about Palestine. And I always think about how there was this stat from the early 2000s that the majority of Americans thought that Palestinians had invaded Israel and that Palestinians were the occupying force. We did that. We met that task. We did it through massive mobilization and referendum after referendum and die-ins and sit-ins and blockades and all the things. And so I find a lot of hope in the movement, in the work that we did do. I think that we didn't anticipate how little material change the opinion of the American public would actually hold, which it's really wild that there's such a discrepancy. Two-thirds of Americans think that we should have a weapons embargo, and yet less than 15 senators voted for that bill. But I think for me, like, hope isn't necessarily about, and this is a sort of contradiction, because on the one hand, I think movements need to orient towards winning, and we need to constantly be asking ourselves, how do we win? What would winning look like? What is the path between here and a win? And I think that in many ways, we didn't do that in the Palestine movement for so long because we were so far away from winning and we had really no one on our side. And now I think we could win, but we need to shift our strategy. But at the same time, on a personal level, in terms of my own kind of maintaining my sanity or something close to sanity in the world, I have to orient towards movements in terms of process and a commitment to continuing to show up, and not necessarily a sense that if we win, then I stay, or that I think outcomes are beyond us in a way, right? We have to orient towards outcomes, but we have to do the work whether we're going to get those outcomes or not. And I think that's a very difficult position to sit in, but one that I think is really the only way to stay in movements for a lifetime. And I find it very comforting to think that, oh, no, this is, liberation is a lifelong struggle. I actually find a lot of peace and comfort in that, because it makes me think, okay, so how do I make this sustainable, and how do I build long-term relationships, and how do I zoom out, and how do I not get bogged down in the day-to-day frustrations of losing over and over, or having burnt out comrades or being burnt out myself, or like the kind of petty fights that we have in movements because we're so frustrated. Yeah. I think that kind of zooming out for me helps to be like, oh, okay, some perspective, like my comrade and I are fighting this week. It's really not the end of the world. It's not the end of the movement. Those are just some thoughts. I have no magical solutions besides that I don't know how to live in this world. If I'm not struggling, I just can't imagine accepting this. That to me is the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is not to struggle.
Just to insert very quickly, I think it was Robin Kelly has this phrase, success without victory. It's procedural. And this is what your book does so well. And also as somebody of the way older generation, and the reason I put hope in scare quotes is, I find myself just, if I've stayed true to myself, my values every day, then that's a victory. That's something that I can say, I didn't do this, but at least I'm developing a pretty good pattern of things. But Michelle, did you want to get in on this last question?
I'll say a couple of things. I think a man certainly fully answered it. I think that it's worth keeping in mind how the sort of really brutal escalations across much of the world of the rise of fascism in the United States and across a chunk of Europe, and even Israel's escalation and the genocide, are all dimensions of weakness that the liberal, social, democratic, capitalist social order was one that kept them in power and could have made them a lot of money over the long term, and that it wasn't working on some level, that there's some way that the intensification of economic crisis, ecological crisis, social crisis, that there's an underlying weakness and a deterioration in the reproduction of racial capitalism on the world scale and on a national scale. And that there's a faction of the ruling class who is like, no, it's actually fine. We could just keep things how they were. And another faction of the ruling class was like, no, we need Nazism. We need to start killing. That's the only way forward. Yep. And the latter half actually recognized something of the crisis, that there's some way that they are tuned in to the fact that the old social order isn't working anymore. And it's not going to be easily fixed by any means. And that there's some way, there was a French socialist group in the 60s, socialism or barbarism, right? And there's some obvious racist connotations in the latter word, but there's some truth to this, like that the old way of holding society together under the extreme inequalities and extreme violence is unraveling, and that it's increasingly clear to large numbers of people that either we split right into a kind of xenophobic, nationalist, racist, patriarchal politics based on violently asserting some fantasy of white male supremacy and kill anyone who gets in the way, or we split left. And what that actually means was always up for grabs, but that actually it's within collective humanity's capacity to institute a global communist revolution actually quite swiftly, right? More people than ever before can read and write, can communicate on their cell phones, are tapped into social networks that dramatically exceed their particular region where they grew up, are interdependent materially on a global scale so that their labor is in the service on various levels of reproducing society as a whole, or are excluded from stable wage labor more or less permanently. We have billions of people who are not easily incorporated into the stability that wage labor once afforded. And, you know, that there's some level at which, like, actually things could come together really quite fast. Yeah. And if they did, like, the fascists wouldn't stand a chance on some level. And I think that there's, like, much of the left is quite marginal. We're doing our best. We're facing, you know, an extremely well-armed, very powerful enemy. Things are quite grim, and they might stay grim for a while, but that there will be many crises. There are many crises, and that all of those are opportunities to do something quite different and quite dramatically different. And that's part of what our book is about.
What a perfect way to end. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. And the door's always open. This is an amazing conversation. Let's not let it end. So thank you so much again, and have a wonderful rest of your weekend. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.